Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The John Gammy Triennial Symposium gets underway this Thursday at the University of Tulsa and will examine the moral and legal boundaries of biomedical research. Scholars will examine how researchers can become ethically blind, the existing legal protections for human subjects, and what happens when those boundaries are crossed. Well, the keynote address will document two cases where those lines were actually obliterated. Dr. Susan Reverby is the McLean Professor in the History of Ideas and a Professor of Women and Gender Studies at Wellesley College. She's an internationally known acclaimed scholar whose work documenting the abuses of the Tuskegee study by the U.S. Public Health Services has been key. This infamous study followed a group of African-American men infected with syphilis for 40 years, from 1932 through 1972, and deceived the men into believing they were being treated for their illness rather than monitored. Her book examining Tuskegee, the infamous syphilis study and its legacy, won numerous awards. And while researching Tuskegee, Reverby uncovered an equally reprehensible study in Guatemala from 1946 and 1948, where the U.S. Public Health Service actually injected Guatemalan prisoners and military personnel with sexually transmitted diseases, then attempted to cure them with penicillin, all without informed consent. Dr. Reverby will be speaking Thursday evening at 6:30 in a free lecture at the University of Tulsa's Allen Chapman Activity Center, which will start off the Gammy Triennial Symposium. And she joins us by phone today on Studio Tulsa. Susan Reverby, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
A big focus of your work has been on the Tuskegee experiment, which you've been working on and writing about for many years. Of course, in recent years, it has been the disclosure of another public health service study in Guatemala, which was just about as bad. What got you interested in these ideas of sort of borderline or over-the-line ethical medical studies? What got you interested in things like Tuskegee in the first place?
I am an American historian by training in women's history and medical and nursing history, and I originally was going to write a book about a woman named Eunice Rivers, who was the go-between, the African-American men in the study in Tuskegee and the Public Health Service. But there really wasn't enough to really write a book on her. There's a wonderful play and movie
Nurse
called
Evers, yeah.
Miss Evers' Boys, right, which is, and it's fictionalized for a reason, because there really isn't enough historical material to actually sort of say really what she thought, and the playwright makes, you know, 99% of it up. So historians, unfortunately, are not allowed to do that. So I had to find another topic, and by then I had started, so this was probably in the early 90s, and, you know, I just was fascinated by both why the study had happened, but also the role of the African-American doctors and the nurses, in particular Rivers, in making it happen. And I was curious what else could be found out about it. So, you know, it really speaks to a way of thinking about racism in American history, about which I've been concerned for a really long time. So it had sort of everything, you know, sex, you know, racism, a central place in the African-American memory, because Booker T. Washington founds Tuskegee Institute. And, you know, and it really was about ethics and why did the doctors think they were doing the right thing. And so it just raised, I thought, really fascinating questions.
I think that that is the enduring question of this study, is what were the motivations of the doctors who were blinded? They have to be blind. I mean, given the length of this study, I mean, we're talking 40 years pre-World War II, the story of all the Nazi atrocities come out.
Here's the interesting part about that. So yeah. When my colleague Jim Jones, who wrote the first book about the Tuskegee study, asked one of the doctors who had done it why the Nuremberg trials of the Nazi doctors hadn't given him pause, and the doctor looked at him like he was out of his mind and said, but they were Nazis. So part of the that sentence actually is what haunts my work. So I think my job as a historian is to try to understand, if you don't think of these guys as merely sociopathic, racist pigs, why did they think what they were doing was okay? And that's what you have to explain. So my job is to explain how, in the passion for the science and in the belief that they were doing the right thing, which they had, why did they keep doing it? So that's really, I think, to me, the much more interesting historical question. And when one of the doctors who ran the study in the 60s was asked, you know, and he said, well, we were at a war against syphilis, and in a war, soldiers die. So if you think about all the way in which we use war metaphors about illnesses, if you're the general in charge of it, you have to make really hard decisions. So the issue really is, did they have the right to make those kind of decisions? There was no real informed consent, but some of the docs involved in the study later on said they thought the men were volunteers. There was no written protocol about how the study was done. So you can explain it in much more complicated ways.
Conceivably, were there physicians and people involved with the study that came in so late that they made the assumption, given the changing times and the changing ethics of how medical experiments were done, that these men had knowledge of, or had consented at least?
Yes, they did. I mean, their claim in the 1990s, for example, was that they thought the men were volunteers. And if you look at the 13 published reports, by the 40s and 50s, they used the word volunteer. So it is possible, you could argue, that some of the docs at the end of the study really didn't know that the men hadn't been informed. But certainly not for the people who started the study in the 30s and 40s. They knew exactly what they were doing.
It's, you know, it's really hard for us today to look back in hindsight and understand the ethical framework of the time. Were these guys over the line in 1932 when this study started?
No, not really. I mean, mostly what you get in this time period in research is not really informed, that kind of formal informed consent. We have now, I mean, the only informed consent in the entire Tuskegee study was for the autopsies. So the families had to agree and sign off on an autopsy. That they got written consent for, but nothing else. And most of the men were totally deceived and thought that the iron pills and tonics and aspirins that they were getting were cures. And they did that purposely. They said, for example, that the spinal taps, which are diagnostic, were a special treatment. So in an attempt to use what we might now call culturally relevant terminology, they completely hid what they were doing.
Wow. And many of the subjects thought they were being treated, not
they thought they
monitored.
Were all thought they were being treated. That's why they joined the study. And one of the arguments I made when we were in the middle of the fight over the Affordable Care Act is, if you think about it, most of the men signed up for it because they thought they were going to get health care for their families. I mean, one of the prizes, quote unquote, for being in the study was that Nurse Rivers became what I call their sort of private public health nurse. So if anybody got sick in the family, they could call her and she could triage them to somewhere else. And so, you know, there were lots of advantages for them to, quote unquote, be in the study. And so they thought they were being treated.
And this is hard to believe, you know, in a day and age, you know, by the time the 50s roll around, everybody knows about penicillin practically. And it seems like, is this penicillin? At some point, one would ask that question.
Right. Well, what was helpful for me was the men's medical records have all now been opened and are in the National Archives in just outside of Atlanta. So I was able to go through all their medical records. And what I found was that a number of the men, even people who stayed in Tuskegee and others who, you know, were part of the Great Black Migration out of the rural South, actually get to treatment. Because, as you say, by the 50s, all you had to do was sneeze and somebody gave you a penicillin shot. So the problem is, by that point, they're in latency in the disease, and so some of its either cardiovascular or neurological damage would not be fixed by penicillin. But some of the men who didn't have damage were probably helped by the mid-50s.
Now,
but not intentionally. I mean, the Public Health Service did not intend for them to get treated, but I argue that a number of them were able to get to treatment.
When these gentlemen thought they were in treatment, did they in turn spread the disease to other people? The thought that they were being treated and that they were in remission?
Well, here's the interesting part about that. We're all supposed to, syphilis has sort of three stages, and you're only contagious in the first two. So after 5 years, you essentially, the only harm is to your body, not to anyone else's. So all of the men in the study were supposed to be in late latency, that is, in the non-infectious stage of the disease. My look at the data for some of it suggests some of them were still contagious and could easily have passed the disease on, but the intention of the study, it's called, you know, untreated syphilis in the male Negro, but it was intended to be at the latency stage.
Hmm. Now, out of your long-time research on the Tuskegee experiment, you found an equally well, as reprehensible, perhaps even more so reprehensible study that took place in 1946 in Guatemala by, mm-hmm. again, the Public Health Service study. Mm-hmm. Explain this.
Right. So I was doing research for the Tuskegee books, and I was in the archives in Pittsburgh, and I looked into the papers of a man named John Cutler, expecting to find maybe more material on Tuskegee, and all I found was the report of a study that was done in Guatemala by the Public Health Service between 1946 and 48 that involved actually giving syphilis, chancroid, and gonorrhea, all sexually transmitted infections, to prisoners in the major penitentiary, in their mental hospital, in an army barracks, and using sex workers to transmit the disease when they were studying the men in the penitentiary, and then actually giving an inoculum to patients in the hospital and in the army barracks for the disease. And at that point, I'd spent nearly, I don't know, 12, 15 years explaining to everyone that no one was given syphilis, which is true, in Tuskegee. And here's the same doctor who later goes on to Tuskegee doing it in Guatemala. So it was pretty stunning to find this, to say the least. And unlike Tuskegee, where there are 13 published articles, I had never seen anything either in the CDC records, Centers for Disease Control records, or in the published literature about the study in Guatemala.
Do you think it was
as far as I knew, no one else had seen it either.
Do you think this was covered up? It only lasted 2 years, so it must have been a subject of great debate at the time.
Yes. So here's what's interesting about it is, unlike Tuskegee, where they were literally in the 50s inviting, you know, anybody who asked any questions was invited to come down and see it, in Guatemala, because it involved infecting human beings, right, with a sexually transmitted disease, they were much more careful about keeping it quiet. And the letters, this is when, thank God, I'm a historian now, because the email would all have been deep six, but here were the letters back and forth between people in the Public Health Service saying, you know, we couldn't do this in the U.S., we shouldn't really talk about this, we should make sure very few people know about it. So it's a much more, in that sense, they were hiding it much more than they had been. The study in Tuskegee was not hidden at all. The Guatemala study certainly was an attempt to keep only a small number of people knowing what was going on.
Now, the Tuskegee experiment was about monitoring the course of syphilis and other sexually transmitted diseases. In the case mm-hmm. of Guatemala, as you mentioned, they were given the disease, but weren't they being cured? I mean, they were being given antibiotics?
The idea of the study was, so remember, it's 1946. We figure out by 1944 that penicillin will cure early syphilis. So it's a really important moment in syphilis history, because now we're trying to think about, wow, what does this new drug do and what can happen? So what the research in Guatemala was about was to look at whether or not, if someone had been exposed to syphilis, like through unprotected sex, could you give them penicillin and would it then keep them from getting infected? So it means they were trying to look at whether penicillin would work as what's called a prophylaxis, that to prevent the disease from actually happening. So if you know, we call a condom a prophylactic,
right.
That is, it prevents pregnancy, presumably, and disease transmission. The idea was to see if penicillin would work. The problem is, from what we can tell from the data in the reports, not everybody. We don't really know for sure how many people got infected, and we know for sure that everyone who at least they tried to infect, they didn't give them penicillin either.
Wow.
So I was pretty shocked, as you can imagine, by this material. And what I did is I wrote it up for a report. And here's who I think is the real hero, frankly, in this story, is the late David Sensor, who passed away in 2011. But Sensor was the former director of the Centers for Disease Control, and he had been the director toward the end of the Tuskegee study. So it all blew up when he was the director, and I think he understood in ways that probably nobody else could what happens if you don't talk honestly about what happens. So he took my unpublished paper and gave it to the associate director for science at the Centers for Disease Control. And then they sent someone from CDC up to Pittsburgh to look at the material, and then his report and my report made it up the chain of command from CDC, then across to NIH, and then up to the White House. And in October 1st, 2010, President Obama apologized to then-President Colom in Guatemala, and Secretary Sebelius and Clinton apologized directly, and then there was a long report in September of 2011 by the President's Bioethics Commission on the history of this, and the Guatemalans themselves also did a report about a year later.
Hmm. As far as the extent of the study, do we feel like reparation? Has there been any sort of reparations or anything like that? Has that been talked about?
You know, it's really a very, very important and interesting question. So I just got back on Tuesday from a visit to Guatemala, and I met with the former vice president who chaired the committee that wrote the Guatemalan report, and I met with several of the doctors who helped do the statistics and write the report, and we discussed this. So what happened is immediately, of course, as you can imagine, a tort attorney found the case and found people in Guatemala who could claim that they had been harmed, but the case was dismissed in the U.S. courts. And about 6 months ago, I was called by another attorney who said he had a different legal strategy, but I haven't heard anything more about what's going to happen. The government, our government, quietly put more money into what the CDC does in Guatemala and in Central America to help build up, you know, healthcare infrastructure around infectious diseases. But there has been no formal way to get any kind of reparations. And it raises an interesting question of to whom would you give them, because it's really hard to tell from the records who people were. There was a patient, for example, in the mental hospital that's referred to in the records as the mute of St. Marcos. Well, you can't exactly, Google the mute of St. Marcos and find his grandchildren, right? So right. How would you even find? So the lawyers found people who said, I remember this. I was in the barracks at that point. Well, I'm sure the person probably was in the barracks, but whether or not their current illnesses were really caused by this, who knows?
Yeah.
Right? So it makes for a legal case. There's a moral and human rights case to be made here, of course, but not probably, I think, a legal one.
My guest today is Susan Reverby, a professor in the history of ideas, a professor of women's and gender studies at Wellesley College. She's the author of the 2009 book Examining Tuskegee, the Infamous Syphilis Study and Its Legacy. And she also, while working on that book, uncovered unpublished papers about a public health service study that actually infected men and women in army barracks, prisons, and mental hospitals in Guatemala with sexually transmitted diseases. She'll be the keynote speaker for the James Gammey Triennial Symposium this Thursday and Friday at TU. She'll be speaking Thursday evening at 6:30. The theme of the symposium is looking at human subjects, keeping them from harm, looking at the moral legal boundaries of biomedical research. Now, it sounds like this study shut down pretty quick. I mean, it only lasted about 2 years. Mm-hmm. Was that basically a fear of this news getting out? Was it actual debates among the public health service, or whether this was morally or ethically correct?
No, it's a much more simple answer, actually. By 1948, if penicillin works as a cure for early syphilis, why would you spend money trying to figure out whether it works as a prophylaxis? Because at that point, they really began to think that the disease would actually go away. So the money starts to dry up at the federal level for what's then called venereal diseases, what we now call sexually transmitted infections. And basically, Cutler is told, and he's not having a really good time getting results. He's having trouble transmitting the disease, frankly, and they just decide it's just too much money. They can't afford it. They've got to use their resources elsewhere, and he's told to close up shop and come home. So he leaves, his lab equipment to help build infrastructure in Guatemala and comes back, and actually he goes off to Afghanistan and India to do other kinds of research.
Do you think there are more Guatemalas out there?
I always get asked this, and I keep saying, it's not like I walk into an archive and the stuff comes flying out at me. So do I think that immoral research is going on now? Absolutely, somewhere. Whether it's exactly like this, no. But are there ways in which, in the search for answers, which we need, do people cut corners? Do they not exactly explain what they're doing to subjects? Do people sign up for things because they need the money? Do doctors in under-resourced areas say yes to a drug company because that's the only way they can get anything for people in their community? Sure.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking from a historical basis, I did a little bit of reading, and it was really kind of shocking as I looked over the history of, this is The Tuskegee is perhaps the most infamous in our country, and this was one that hasn't been heard before, but there were a number of really shockingly unethical medical studies that took place even after World War II, when we started thinking about the Nazis. And I think that story is very haunting, that we're not Nazis.
Yeah, but we're not. And so my concern about both Guatemala and Tuskegee is that it's too easy now to say, but they were racist, or, you know, frankly, people in the North say, oh, but it was the South, or people will say, oh, they were imperialist running dogs, and it was, you know, Guatemala. So I think it's really important to try to understand that these doctors thought what they were doing was right, that they had the right to make these decisions, and to consider, if you're talking to medical and research personnel, why we always have to be vigilant about research, why there have to be people from the communities on these study boards to look at what's going on, because sometimes you just get, all of us, it happens to all of us, you get so caught up in your own worldview that you don't understand that somebody else could see it differently.
Well, I think the one thing about Guatemala that just strikes a chord with that sort of accounting of unethical medical treatment was the subject matter. It was prisoners, it was people in the army, and mental institutions. And when you look even in this country, there were a lot of really unethical, to say the least, medical experiments, like injecting people with live cancer cells. Again, these were prisoners in the U.S. prisons.
No, that one was in a Jewish chronic disease hospital, actually in New York.
Oh, uh-huh.
So the one that the title of the book is fabulous. It's a dermatology doctor who did research at a prison, and he called it Acres of Skin.
Oh, he
looked out at the prisoners and saw acres of skin.
Wow.
Yeah, no, it's quite stunning. On the other hand, what we also have to remember is many of us, me included, are alive because we do medical research. So what we want to do is not stop research from happening. We want to just make sure that it's done in the most ethical way and that we don't take advantage of people who are imprisoned or contained or very poor, who end up giving their lives to science without really knowing what's happening and are coerced, essentially.
You know, you're seeing a lot of articles about exactly that happening to this day. I mean, there are hotels in certain major American cities where basically people come to live for a few weeks, and they're in that last stage where they're basically looking at the drug to see what sort of harm it could cause, and it's people who are basically saying, I need the money, this is what I'm going to use my body for.
Right, exactly. Well, that's where what we would call the structural violence happens, that people are put in a situation where they, quote, give consent, but it really, it's what one author was writing about the Holocaust called it choiceless choice. So these are people who are in a choiceless choice situation. So they're saying yes, but they really don't have an option of saying no because it's the only way they can survive.
Well, what about the reaction of the U.S. government to this knowledge now of this public health service study in Guatemala? It sounds like you were pretty impressed with the fact that this didn't become a simmering secret for a number of years.
Right.
The government
right.
was very open in acknowledging it and taking action.
Yeah, it was really amazing. I mean, I had worked on we finally got an apology for the study in Tuskegee in 1997, and that was 25 years after the study ended, and there were only 6 men still alive. When that happened, they've now all passed away, and their wives have all passed away. But this, I mean, I gave the material to David Sensor in, I don't know, March or April, maybe, and we got the apology in October of the same year. I think that's, like, utterly amazing. In government time, that's, like, in 2 seconds. So I thought it was pretty remarkable that they did this. They certainly didn't have to do it, you know. I mean, you could argue that they politically probably should, once my paper was going to be published, but, you know, I think they acted incredibly swiftly and did the right thing at that point. I would still argue that some kind of reparations should probably have been part of the package, but certainly wasn't up to me to make that decision.
My guest today is Susan Reverie. She's a professor of women and gender studies at Wellesley College. She's the author of the 2009 book Examining Tuskegee. And while working on that book, she uncovered another public health service study from 1946 to 1948 in Guatemala, which involved infecting men and women with sexually transmitted diseases, then offering to cure at least most of them. She'll be the keynote speaker for the James Gammy Triennial Symposium held this week at the University of Tulsa. She'll be speaking Thursday evening at 6:30 at the Alan Chapman Activity Center. What are the important truths we need to know from the legacy of Tuskegee and Guatemala and many other studies from, you know, soldiers being put on the edge of a nuclear test site in Nevada in the late 1940s to cancer studies, to all sorts of biological studies and chemical studies that is a part of our medical research history, the shadowy side of our medical research stories.
Right. And I think we have to really think about, I mean, obviously, if you're going to war against a disease, you can't exactly have a vote. You know, okay. But you have to really think about who gets forced into volunteering. Let's put it that way. So one of the lessons here is why we need institutional review boards, which we now have mandated for federal research since the 1980s, why we should have community people involved in overseeing certain kinds of medical research, and why we really have to think strongly about who gets forced into volunteering, quote unquote. I think that's, for me, the most important thing. And the study in Tuskegee, for example, would never have happened if the physicians hadn't mistakenly believed that there was a different course of the disease in blacks and whites. So it's also the racism that becomes involved in the way we think about biology and medicine that's also at the heart of really, at least for Tuskegee, not so much with Guatemala. That was really more taking advantage of the economic situation and social situation there, because patients were, prisoners were allowed to bring sex workers into the prison. But it really is, in the end, about who oversees research and how we control it.
I'm glad you brought up medical review boards, because I've read a couple of accounts and had a guest or two on who've talked about the fact that there's a big disparity, even today, between what sort of medical review board you go through in preparation of trials. For example, I think universities are very rigorous today.
Mm-hmm.
Other places, maybe not so.
Right, right. You can actually, there are now basically by yourself an IRB. There are commercial IRBs that you can go through, but I would argue, you know, at the university, it's not like you're doing a blinded review. So you know that it's Dr. So-and-so whose project it is, and if he's got a giant lab and he brings in all the money, you know, there's going to be pressure on that IRB to approve something. So, you know, it isn't just that the commercial IRBs are really, you know, the ones where you can get your project bought and sold. I think that one of the questions for me, having served as a consumer representative on a Food and Drug Administration advisory board in the 90s, is when drugs in particular or devices come through the FDA, is there enough oversight of what kind of informed consent went into the research itself. So not just looking at what kind of results the company had, but how ethically was the study done. And my memory of doing this in the 90s was there was no real oversight at that point. So I think until we say to Pfizer or Merck or somebody, guess what? This was a really, not just that the study was done badly, but that the informed consent and where you went and how you did it is really bad, and we think it's unethical. We're not approving your drug. So I think until somehow there are financial consequences for the people who do the research, we're not going to have a lever.
All right. Well, we look forward to your visit here. Susan Reverby, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me to your show.
Dr. Susan Reverby is a professor of women's and gender studies and the McLean Professor in the History of Ideas at Wellesley College. She's also the author of Examining Tuskegee, the Infamous Syphilis Study and Its Legacy. She'll be the keynote address speaker for the John Gammey Triennial Symposium, which will look at the moral and legal boundaries of biomedical research, Thursday and Friday at the University of Tulsa's Alan Chapman Activity Center. She'll be speaking Thursday evening at 6:30. That lecture is free and open to the public. Information on the symposium at 918-631-2463. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.